In 2017, towards the end of the annual gathering of Unitarian Universalists, which was that year held in New Orleans, two employees of the Unitarian Universalist Association who had been there in attendance were attacked and robbed by four young men. You may have read about it. The whole thing was actually caught on video, and then that video ended up going viral everywhere. So one of the men that was attacked actually ended up in the ICU, and for a time, they weren't even sure that he was going to make it. The local police were quick to respond, saying they were sure, especially given the video, they would catch the attackers, catch them and bring them to justice. Bringing someone to justice is something that we say when someone does something very bad, right? Something that is often life-defying, life-destroying, especially in those moments when we haven't yet caught them, right? It is such a common phrase, in fact, that people use after a public moment of harm that I'm guessing when you hear it, the idea of bringing someone to justice, a promise to bring someone to justice, you probably can flash on some moment where you've heard someone say that phrase. For me, that moment that comes to mind is the response to the attacks of 9/11. Right? Maybe you remember George W. Bush promising that he would bring those who perpetrated this attack to justice. And then later, when the news came out that Osama bin Laden had been killed, the constant phrase in response was congratulations to President Obama and the military for bringing bin Laden to justice. From Dick Cheney to Bill Clinton, they all use this phrase. Colin Powell, he varied a little. He said, justice has been done. There's an implicit definition of justice in this phrase and in the way it is collectively interpreted in our culture, which is to conflate justice with punishment. That is punishment that corresponds to the harm that was caused. In my example, bin Laden was understood to have caused death, destruction, and so the just punishment was death, right? In his death, bin Laden was brought to justice. The men who were attacked in New Orleans, however, like a lot of Unitarian Universalists, had a different understanding of justice, based not in punishment but in restoration. As one of the victims wrote in a letter to the judge, they said they hoped that their attackers would not go to prison and experience that punishment-based kind of justice, but rather that they could go through a process of restorative justice. A community and relationship-based approach where harms could be acknowledged and the work could be done to repair the damage. One podcast I listened to recently, it was with an interview with a prosecutor, and he was talking about why so many prosecutors have resistance to this idea of restorative justice. He said it was because they all thought of it as kind of a conflict-avoidant way to try to brush aside the harm that the person caused and avoid accountability. This is, of course, entirely untrue. Restorative justice does not avoid accountability, but rather it places accountability in the context of the human relationships impacted by the harm. It centers the people that were impacted, and invites them to identify what could be done to repair that harm, if anything. What could be done to begin to make things right? Restorative justice also looks not just at individual impact, but the collective impact, including the question of how we would reintegrate the person who caused that harm. Because restorative justice affirms that no one is disposable. And as Bryan Stevenson says, each of us is more than our worst act. This was the affirmation at the heart of what the UUA employees were requesting of the judge. The judge received their letter, received their request, and then proceeded to give each of the men, all age 19 or 22, prison sentences ranging from 3 years to 8 years. The power of the violence in the video, remember? It went everywhere. And the fact that one of the victims almost died, it was just too much. There had to be punishment. They couldn't imagine, the system couldn't imagine what justice would look like without it. These questions about justice remind me of a story that I heard often growing up. You might be familiar with it as well. It's the story of two brothers and their very rich father who had given these two brothers everything they could ever want. Until one day, the younger brother told his father, "Dad, I don't want to wait until you die to get my inheritance. I'd like it now." And the dad said, "Okay." And he gave him then half of all of his money. And the younger son was like, "Score!" And I'm out of here. He took off. He went on to be reckless, destructive, selfish. He had a ton of fun. But also, he stopped calling his family, lost touch with his friends. His dad tried to find him, figure out where he had gone, but he couldn't. And eventually, his dad started to think that he was dead. Until, you'll be shocked, he ran out of money. And he was completely broke, and eventually, he was even homeless. He was so ashamed. He knew he couldn't go back to his father after all of that, so he decided that he should look for work. But because he didn't have any school and he didn't have any connections anymore, the only job that he was qualified for that he could find that somebody would hire him was a job feeding pigs. Pigs, right? And this job, I mean, it barely paid anything. He could still barely eat. One day he was so hungry, he just wanted to eat the slop that he'd been feeding the pigs. This was his low point. And finally, he decided his dad had a whole bunch of people that were working for his dad, that were eating well, sleeping well. He didn't think he had any right to ask his father to accept him back as his son. But he thought he might be willing to give him a job. And so he headed home right away. And as he came towards the house, his father saw him, and he ran to him and embraced him and kissed him. And the son started, he said, "Dad, I'm so sorry. I know I hurt you so terribly. I hurt the whole family. I hurt so many people. I don't even deserve to be your son." But his father was having none of it. Instead, he called out to everyone who worked for him, told them to get his son new clothes, new shoes, and to get ready for a feast right away because his son was alive and he'd returned. Meanwhile, the responsible firstborn had never left. He heard about his brother's return and his father's response, and he was like, "WTF, Dad?" Right? Because the whole time his brother had been gone partying or whatever, he had stayed behind and helped his dad, consoled him when he thought his other son was dead. Right? Stuck with it through everything. And I'm sure there were moments along the way where he thought, "If he ever comes back, I hope he is brought to justice." Right? But instead, here he comes back, and I mean, like, not even a stern talking to? I mean, they were having a feast? It was ridiculous and unfair. Nothing that he would call just. The older brother in this moment was experiencing what psychologist and researcher Michael McCullough calls our revenge craving. Right? Literally. When researchers look at people's brains after they have witnessed harm or experienced harm, any sort, then they see a reaction in our brains. It's a reaction that's really similar to what your brain looks like when you're thirsty, and then you can kind of see on the horizon a sweet drink. Or when you're really hungry, and then you can see in your future your favorite food. That's what your brain looks like. It's a physical reaction, and we all have it. We tend to think of revenge, the desire for revenge, as an aberration, a destructive, abhorrent, and punishment as something that indicates an evil impulse in us. And it's true, of course, revenge has caused a lot of problems. I mean, the destructive consequences of revenge are basically the plot of like 75% of Shakespeare and Greek dramas, right? And they're like a whole category on Netflix, like revenge dramas. It's true, I think. But what McCullough's research has shown is that seeking punishment is also a normal way of reacting to behavior that is personally or socially harmful. It is a normal craving that's attempting to solve a problem and accomplish a goal. And actually, seeking punishment, he says, can even be for the good. He tells a story about one study that had participants playing a game. So in this game, all the participants in the study were each given $20, right? And then they were told that if they gave some or all of their money to a shared pot, then that money in the shared pot would be doubled, and then it would be redistributed back out to everyone, including anyone who didn't contribute to the shared pot, right? So, like, let's say that we all contribute $20, and then we put it into a pot, and then everyone except for, I don't know, you. Jude does not give the $20, but everybody else gives $20, right? And so then that pot gets doubled. It's somewhere like $5,000 or so, right? And so that gets redistributed. And then we all end up with, I don't know, how much does that come out to? Like $45, $50, somewhere in there, depending on how many are here today. But anyway, but Jude, she gets more like $60 or $70 even, right? The participants in the study do not like that. We probably wouldn't either, right? So much so that when the participants realize that somebody is doing this, they decide over time to just stop pooling their money too, just to get back at the freeloaders, right? Freeloaders are actually one of the strongest triggers of our revenge craving. What's interesting, though, is that when people stop contributing, that actually that means that they ended up with less money, of course. They only get to have what they originally had. So they punish the freeloaders, but they also end up punishing themselves. This is what's known as altruistic punishment, right? And it's instinctual, too. Even if it doesn't directly benefit us, could harm us even, we're willing to punish someone if it seems that their behavior is hurting the collective good. But on the other hand, when the study gave the same participants a more active punishment option, like an option where that was something less altruistic, as in they told them that they could punish anyone who they thought was freeloading with a fine, the participants took to this very well. They gave out all the fines, and also they gave all their contributions. Immediately, all the contributions went back up, and the freeloading went way down, eventually to nothing. This sort of study has been repeated in various ways, all with the same conclusion. That is, our instinct for punishment is normal and can be for the good, as it sometimes can encourage cooperative behavior, behavior that benefits everyone. This conclusion basically freaks me out, right? Because it goes against everything that I've been taught for most of my life about an ethical response to human misbehavior, even an effective response to human misbehavior. I mean, I grew up with that story of the returning son as a lesson for how to live, as in be like the dad. Don't be like the older brother. I mean, he's a jerk, right? I mean, no one ever suggested to me that the older brother is having a biologically determined reaction. No one ever said that his reaction might even be helpful, might even be for the good, that his version of justice could, in some way, help people cooperate and get along. Instead, the story ends with the dad reprimanding him. He was like, I thought your brother was dead, and instead he's alive and he's here, and that's all that matters. You just need to get over it. These two responses to injustice, the dad and the older sons, parallel the two sides of a major argument that our universalist faith had in the early 19th century. It is an argument about what it means to be brought to justice in a very ultimate sense. Universalism as a distinct faith began in the 18th century with the arrival of John Murray on the shores of New Jersey in 1770. When he began preaching a new message, a message of God's love and universal salvation. Universal. What we don't usually clarify about Murray, though, is that he was not a universalist in the way that we tend to think about universalists historically today. As in, Murray believed in hell. He believed that if you died without ever having been truly remorseful or atoned for the harm that you'd caused, you would go to hell. You go there and be punished until the day of judgment when all humans would go together to heaven in universal salvation. Like the older brother in our story, this idea made perfect sense to those early universalists because justice had to include some version of punishment. That is, until the turn of the century when a young preacher named Hosea Ballou entered the scene and took things quite a bit further. Ballou's big claim was that God was a lot more like the dad in our story than the older brother. As in, it didn't matter what you've done. God's love was entirely embracing, transforming, healing, perfect, so that when we die, we are all immediately welcomed, forgiven, embraced, no punishment required. Ballou's side of the argument was called ultra-universalism at the time, or death and glory, as in you die and you go immediately to glory. Death and glory. The other side were called simply the restorationists, because they believed that something had to be done to restore a person, that justice required something, some kind of punishment. Not eternal, necessarily, but some, maybe a lot, depending on what you've done. But then after that punishment, God's love would prevail, and everyone would be saved together. Now, in our faith today, we've pretty much stopped arguing about what happens in some other life because we've got our hands full just thinking about what justice means in this life. Right? This major turn to focus on this life rather than some future one can mostly be credited to the leadership of the Universalist minister Clarence Skinner in the 20th century. His work, Social Implications of Universalism, focused our attention on the hell we experience in this life rather than the hell after death. Maybe even more importantly, Skinner also reoriented our understanding of sin so that it was never adequate, he said, to think of sin as something that was caused by an individual. But rather, sin is always a matter of the collective, the society, so that often the impact of sin, that is, hell, is experienced not just by one person, but by many, collectively. Which also means that salvation in this life, what some would call liberation, must be collective. We are all in this together. Which is why I think, despite its potential for the good, we need to be careful about how much we lean into that human instinct for punishment. For so many reasons, but not the least of which is what our reading describes, that is, the impact that punishment has on the one doing the punishing. As in, once you get started punishing, you naturally want to continue. It allows you to feel both self-righteous and powerful. Which is another reason. That is, while it's true, punishment can increase cooperation, it is also true that it can be used to reinforce dominance and control, power over rather than power with, and also be used to ensure compliance with existing social norms. This is all in McCullough's research too, which means that if the existing social norms, the society, as Skinner would say, if the society is broken and unjust, then punishment will almost always reinforce that injustice and serve to control behavior so that it conforms to continuing whatever has been going on up until that point. So, for example, if society's norms are white supremacy and the control of people of color or people in poverty, then the punishment, if we're not paying close attention to ensure otherwise, will likely reinforce these norms, this dominance, this control. One of the main reasons the UUA employees hoped for a different process than the punishment-based justice of prison is that they had heard their attackers had been living before that point in a local homeless shelter because their lives had been devastated by Hurricane Katrina at a really young age. They'd never really known stability or safety or a life outside of trauma. I mean, and they were 19 and 22. Their brains weren't even fully developed outside of all those other factors. So how would prison help, they thought? Like, how would prison be a just response? I mean, we've known for a long time that prison is not a mode of punishment that inspires more cooperation. Not in most cases, but it does do a pretty good job of reinforcing existing social norms, existing dominance and control. Besides, the victims looked at the attackers' lives, and they, from what they could see, there was already plenty of punishment that had been going on, far beyond what would foster the common good. And actually, this sort of reality that's often at play is why some activists say that even restorative justice processes fall short of real justice. Because what justice was there before that we're wanting to be restoring, right? What conditions are we restoring ourselves back into? Instead, we would do well to add a third way to how we think about justice, a way called transformative justice. As activist Adrienne Marie Brown describes, transformative justice is about transforming the conditions in society, community, family, and/or intimate relationships from the root, such that whatever is causing the harm and tension comes undone. Transformative justice sounds a lot like the model that Clarence Skinner was after in his call to tend to the social systems that create the hell for all of us. Now, in our faith today, I would say we are still wrestling with what it means, really, to bring someone to justice. And yet, at least when it comes to this life, I find myself, through all of these considerations for the sermon, to often finding myself on the side of the restorationist. That is, that there may be a role for punishment in justice. I know, I'm as surprised as you are. Except by punishment, I mean more like the sort of forbearance that our Unitarian ancestors said was at the core, was core to the practice of covenant. That is the sort of punishment that is set out in the context of human connection and human relationship. That is punishment that is not delegated out to some state or other adjudicatory body, but with a full commitment to the universalist conviction that we are all in this life together. That is punishment that would keep an eye on its potential to reinforce rather than upend unjust social norms. And when it's used sparingly, in a way connected to the behavior itself. I think about my daughter, for example. She's 14. And when she misuses her phone, and then I have to take away the phone for a while, right? That's punishment that's connected to the behavior. But when then I can imagine that somehow, in this mode, maybe punishment could be part of what it means to be brought to justice, which is the justice that can only be found in the context of real restoration and with deep transformation. Because only then, with all of these at play, can we truly declare all of us brought to justice and bound for glory. May it be so, and amen.